their colleagues, friends, and Academy members. I wish you all a warm welcome to this event at the beautiful Norwegian Academy of Science and Letters in Oslo. My name is Sven-Erik Mamlund, and I'm professor in pandemic studies and the head and founder of Center for Research on Pandemics in Society, PANSOC, at Oslo Metropolitan University. I'm also head of the organizing team of this event and will be your host this evening. So we have invited two of the most prominent international experts on the virology of influenza, and in particular, the virology of the so-called Spanish flu pandemic that claimed the life of 50 to 100 million people globally, or 2.5 to 5% of the global population at the time. Our guest speakers will both talk about the hunt for the virus causing the 19th flu and how it has informed science and preparedness for future pandemics. Our speakers, they are invited on behalf of the ongoing Center for Advanced Study project called Social Science Meets Biology, Indigenous Peoples and Severe Influenza Outcomes, that I myself lead. The influenza pandemics of 1918, 2009, as well as the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, shows that some indigenous peoples have extremely high risk of severe disease outcomes, but reasons for this vulnerability is still unclear. In our CAST project, we have brought together a team of 15 different researchers from 3 continents and 6 countries to foster interdisciplinary conversations that integrate biological and social sciences perspectives in order to increase the understanding of indigenous experiences when faced with pandemic diseases and better appreciate the diversity of pandemic consequences faced by indigenous versus non-indigenous peoples. As you soon will hear more about, the search for the 1980 flu virus with critical samples from an indigenous village in Brevik, Alaska, where 90% of the population died from the Spanish flu, has played a key role in reconstructing the highly potent 1918 flu virus in laboratories. These laboratories studies have also given clues to why mortality was so high in remotely living indigenous populations and also elsewhere. The two speakers will speak for 30 minutes each. We will open up the floor for questions after the first talk. And after the second talk, you can ask both presenters questions. Our first speaker is Jeffrey Tarnberger. He is chief of the viral pathogenesis and evolution section and deputy chief of the Laboratory of Infectious Diseases, National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the United States. And Tarnberger is a member of the Association of American Physicians and the American Academy of Microbiology. Tarnberger has published over 250 papers on influenza and coronavirus, virus biology, pathophysiology, clinical research, and development of a universal influenza vaccine and coronavirus vaccines. Among his key contributions to the field was the sequence reconstruction and characterization of the virus responsible for the 19 influenza pandemic. Our second speaker is John Oxford. He is Professor Emeritus of Virology at Queen Mary University of London, UK. He was trained by Geoffrey C. Child and Sir Charles Stewart Harris at the Lochmore Infectious Disease Hospital in Sheffield. And he has worked with prominent researchers such as Robert Webster and Graham Laver at the John Curtin School for Medical Research in Canberra, Australia. Oxford is also president and the scientific director and founder of the research company RetroScreen Virology Limited to create the next generation of antivirals and vaccines in the field of biomedical research. And together with Stuart Harris, that I just mentioned, he wrote The Human Virology, published by Oxford University Press, which is now in its fifth edition. And he has also published over 300 scientific papers. And I now give the word to our first speaker, Jeffrey Thalberger. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Professor Mumlin, for the very kind introduction and for the great honor of the invitation here to visit you and your colleagues and be here in the lovely city at this time. I have a task to introduce the topic of the 1918 influenza and our work to understand it and where it came from and why it was so pathogenic and its lessons for the future, and that will be followed by John, who will continue this topic. So basically, I have 30 minutes to summarize 30 years of work, so we'll do about 1 year per minute, so let's go. Wrong way. So just very, very briefly, try to cover a lot of topics, but just introduce the main opponent here that we have. This is the influenza A virus. I'm not going to go into all the details, but it's a single-stranded RNA virus, and the characteristic features of that is that, unlike a DNA virus, it doesn't have proofreading, so that when it makes copies of itself, it induces a lot of errors. It's a very sloppy typer, in a sense. And so the virus lives in sort of a swarm of an infinite variety of mutations. And so the virus, while most of those are probably negative, can be rapidly adapted in a positive way. If a bird virus finds itself in the nose of a pig or a human or a horse, maybe one of these mutations has a random but selective advantage to that virus, and it could replicate in a new host. If it's exposed to antiviral drugs, you can rapidly develop resistance to that. If population immunity is built up through pre-infection or vaccination, the virus can find ways to mutate to escape from that, which is why the vaccines have to be made all the time. So without getting into the complications of it, just to say this is a very difficult virus to tackle because it is so flexible in its kind of infinite genetic variability. The thing that makes it very complicated is that we think of influenza in humans, and this is, of course, very important to us, and influenza is one of the major killers of humans, but influenza is really kind of an accidental virus of humans. It's really a virus of many hundreds of bird species, mostly aquatic waterfowl like ducks and geese and shorebirds, where it's a GI virus, and it's shed through oral fecal spread and shed from the cloacas of these birds, which are shown anatomically here. It moves around in very complicated ways with bird migration patterns and so on, but it has the incredible ability to not only just periodically infect other animals, but to actually adapt to new host species, so you can get bird viruses adapting to domestic chicken and turkey farms, quail to domestic pigs, to horses, to dogs, to a whole slew of wild animals as diverse as whales and seals and camels and felines and ferrets and so on. So again, influenza is a much bigger problem than people, and this the ability of these viruses to unexpectedly move to people is a big part of what we're concerned about. So basically, to summarize, you know, I spent most of my career trying to worry about how a virus gets from this orifice to that one, and whether it's, you know, directly or through some other intermediate like this pig. And I can just say for the record that with informed consent, they both seem to be having a very good time here. So, usually I show all these old grainy pictures about 1918, and it's hard to imagine the world with people who were isolated and wearing masks and doing all these crazy things, and it's a lot easier to explain it now. Everything that was old is new again, right? So people wore masks, they masked their dogs and cats, they wore colorful masks with crossbones and so on. It played baseball wearing a mask. I watched baseball in a mask. So, you know, everything that happened in 1918, you've all been living through for the last 3 years. I don't have to convince you. Of course, the impact of the 1918 flu, I mean, in terms of epidemiology, as Professor Mamelin said, you know, conservatively 50 million people died in 1918 and early 1919, maybe 100 million people. We'll never know the whole extent. But of course, that had a major effect on all aspects of society. Of course, it affected the arts and literature as well as all society. But of course, the famous expressionist painter Egon Schiele died about an hour apart from his pregnant wife, Edith, in the same bed in October 1918 of the flu. Gustav Klimt also died of pneumonia in 1918. And of course, Norway's Edvard Munch was very sick with the 1918 flu but didn't recover. This is a self-portrait of him during his convalescence. So as I said, the mortality is still unknown, but I think 50 million is a good baseline number. So in the United States, it's about 675,000 people. You know, to put that in context, in a city like Philadelphia, 16,000 people died, 11,000 just in the month of October 1918. So if you think of a city like that and the impact of this kind of mortality. The U.S. military suffered about 100,000 U.S. losses, fatalities in World War I, far less than the European combatants because we entered quite late. But of those, 40% of those deaths were flu deaths. So these were very healthy 18 to 25-year-old men who dropped dead of influenza, 30,000 of those 43,000 in the month of October 1918, most of them in training camps in the United States. The influenza virus was most visible in its so-called fall wave, if we're northern hemisphere-centric, but both in the northern and southern hemisphere in the sort of September to November timeframe, our fall, the southern hemisphere's spring, it was the major outbreak. But there were some places that had what looks epidemiologically like a wave in the late spring, early summer, and then some locations had secondary waves like this in February, March, and other locations did not. So the patterns are a little bit different, but everyone is mostly consistent with the major wave occurring in the last few months of 1918. A very unusual feature about the mortality in 1918 was that while influenza before and since tends to affect all ages, those who have the highest risk of dying tend to be the elderly and infants. So you have sort of a U-shaped age-specific mortality. In 1918, very specifically and very characteristically, you had the so-called W-shape in which there's a new peak of mortality in what seemed to be young, healthy adults. So it's a 15 to 40-year-olds, peak mortality of about age 26 to 28. And this is really something seen all over the world. So it's really a feature of the virus that we have not yet fully explained. Of course, very different than the age mortality that we've seen with COVID, where it's predominantly in the elderly populations. Influenza pandemics have probably been occurring for hundreds, if not thousands of years. We estimate that since 1510, there have been 14 influenza pandemics, averaging about every 35 to 40 years, with no periodicity. But we only know anything about the last four pandemics from 1918, the 1957 Asian flu, and 1968 Hong Kong flu, and the 2009 so-called swine flu. And these are the subtypes of the viruses. The 1918 was H1N1, and H1N1 has come back and then in a new form in 2009, and in 1968 the H3N2 virus is still circulating among us 50 years later. So now we have both H1 and H3 viruses circulating. So in 1918, there were just beginning to formulate the concept of viruses as infectious agents, and so there were no isolates made of the virus, and since influenza viruses mutate so very rapidly, after the pandemic ended, there was a great hunt for influenza viruses, which not accomplished to 15 to 20 years later in the 1930s. But by the time that happened, they were isolating swine viruses in pigs and human viruses, seasonal influenza viruses in humans. But the 1918 strain itself, of course, had gone away. And so there was nothing that anyone could do to look at the reasons for this extreme mortality. So in 1995, when I was at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology at the Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, D.C., sitting on a collection of archival pathology material going back about 150 years, we were developing molecular diagnostic techniques to be useful for modern pathology diagnosis. I had the sort of crazy idea that we could go back and find autopsy tissues of people who died of the flu in 1918, their lung tissues preserved in formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue in a little bit of paraffin wax about the size of your fingernail, and their representative sections that could be cut from these blocks and then stained with dyes to look at under the microscope. So the Institute had about 100 such autopsies, and about 75 of them still had tissues. And we began the effort to try to recover tiny, tiny fragments of the viral RNA or viral genome. and began to make success. And then a huge contribution was my Swedish-American colleague, Dr. Johan Holten, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year at the age of 97. Who had a very important role in recovery of the 1918 virus. As Dr. Mamelud alluded to study the enormous impact of the virus in small Inuit communities in northwestern Alaska, in particular in Brevik Mission, where about 90% of the adult population died, and the bodies were buried in the permafrost on the bluff overlooking the Bering Strait there, right on the beach between those two crosses. So you've already heard about this from Dr. Mamelun. So Dr. Holten had the same idea as mine to find the source of the 1918 flu, but his idea was in 1949. He did an exhumation in 1951 and got permission to do exhumation. They tried to culture the virus then. You know, there was no containment. They didn't have biological safety cabinets. They were mouth pipetting, infecting eggs, infecting ferrets, and it's kind of a good thing maybe they didn't recover the 1918 influenza. But he gave up on this project and then had a successful career doing other things. And then when I published the first sequences from our formal and fixed autopsy tissues, he wrote me a letter saying that he still had connections here to the village council and could do another exhumation. So that was done, and that material made possible the initial sequence analysis to complete the genome of the 1918 virus. Using techniques that we thought were quite sophisticated in the mid-1990s, that we pushed technology. The amount of viral RNA in this material is at about the femtogram to attogram level, so that's 10 to the minus 21, which is a very tiny number. And most of the RNA is just small oligonucleotides of under 10 bases or so. Most of the fragments were about under 20. There are some fragments in the sort of 60 to 100 range, but it was an incredibly tedious process. And using the techniques available to us at the time, it took us about 10 years to sequence the genome of the virus from this material. And we had at point positive material from Alaska, from our U.S. soldiers, and then from collaboration with Professor Oxford's group from material from the Royal London Hospital. After the sequences were rebuilt, it became possible to, using reverse genetics, rescue the 1918 virus in high containment laboratories such as mine at the National Institutes of Health to investigate experimental pathogenesis of the virus. So if we go back and look at autopsy tissues of people who died of influenza in 1918, just very briefly, this is what a normal lung would look like. It's mostly air, right? So you have these very delicate little air sacs, the alveoli, where air exchange occurs, and then there's sort of a branching tree. If the air sacs are the leaves, you have the trunk, the trachea, and then the bronchi, the major branches into the bronchioles that eventually lead to the airspace. So this is what normal lungs should look like. These are H&E stains of 1918 autopsy material, stained in 1918, just photographed now. They're still beautiful. But what this shows is here's a lung in which all the air spaces are completely filled with this pink stuff. This is edema fluid. This person basically drowned in edema fluid. Here the alveoli, all the cells are inflamed and dead and dying. Here you see this edema fluid and protein material being pushed up against the air spaces to prohibit oxygen transport. And another prominent feature was very prominent blood clots that pathologists reported in 1918, which we'll get back to in a minute. But while you can see these primary features of viral pneumonia, almost 100% of people in 1918 died with a secondary bacterial pneumonia. So they acquired the viral pneumonia first and then got a secondary bacterial pneumonia, and that's what killed most of them. And of course, there were no antibiotics, and so you see untreated bacterial bronchopneumonias like you would not see today, in which you have just complete obliteration of the lungs with the bacterial bronchopneumonia. You can, even on H&E, see the bacteria. But mostly these were gram-positive bacterial infections, so staphylococcus, group A strep, or pneumococcus. The influenza virus lived and replicated in the airways from nose all the way down to the air sacs and the alveoli, so it replicated along the whole respiratory tract very efficiently. And we have looked at about 75 cases in which most of them occurred in this fall wave, but we have some cases going as early as May in this early first wave. The earliest sequence we have is from a case from May 11th, 1918. And the latest case we have is one from February 1919. So the most important first lesson I want to point out is that the virus that caused the pandemic in 1918, in a sense, never really went away. It has continued to evolve as human flu, and it has updated itself genetically to form these new pandemics that we've seen in the last 100 years. So I can say that unlike just the idea of the pandemic, that 50 million people died in 1918, tens of millions of people have died in the last century from the virus that resulted from a single transmission of an avian virus from birds to humans in 1918. We're still in the pandemic era. So this year, flu deaths that will occur, whether it's H1 or H3, will all, in a sense, be still the direct result of this single 1918 pandemic. Luckily now, technology has advanced a lot since 25 years ago, and now using new techniques, which I don't have to go into detail of, we can sequence the full genome of a 1918 virus in just a couple of weeks rather than 10 years, which is good because I'm old and impatient. And so we are completing three new genomes now, and with colleagues around the world, we are doing similar studies and finding additional material. So now we have about two dozen complete or partial 1918 genomes, which is very good. Compared to COVID, there are about a million COVID genomes in GenBank now, so you know we're not good like that. But the more diversity we can find from the more places and more time points, we can look at 1918 better. It suggests that the 1918 virus may have originated at some point maybe in around 1917, and I think John will talk about that. We don't know how the 1918 pandemic emerged or where, but by the time it was recognized in the fall of 1918, it clearly was spread all over the world. If you look at U.S. Military deaths in the military camps and look at their case records, what you find is that there was a small outbreak of influenza in the early parts of 1918, but very little associated bronchopneumonia. But while in the summer there were hardly any cases at all, and while these are very tiny numbers, almost every influenza death was associated with a secondary bronchial pneumonia, and then the fall wave hit where it was almost 100%. So we think that actually evidence of an influenza and a secondary bacterial bronchopneumonia might be a very sensitive marker of the pandemic, and that finding early material in which you see this connection would be very important. So in the next part of the talk, I will very briefly summarize the sort of a triangulate around the different aspects that have led to the 1918 virus being so virulent as it was. So, of course, there were host factors, there were virus factors, and there were secondary bacterial pneumonia factors. So in host, of course, the things that Dr. Memelin is studying, the nutritional status, socioeconomic status, other things. Of course, there are genetic variations person to person and between different groups of people. But we're particularly interested in the host inflammatory response associated with the viral infection itself, how the host interacts with the virus as it replicates, and what the viral virulence factors are, and then how secondary bacterial pneumonias play a role. So we talked briefly about host inflammatory factors. The 1918 influenza, unlike most human influenza viruses or other avian influenza viruses, when it infects human cells or mammalian cells, induces an extraordinarily profound pro-inflammatory response where the lungs just fill up with neutrophils. This is very unusual compared to 2009 influenza virus where you don't see any neutrophils. Upregulates genes associated with pro-inflammatory response, type 1 interferons, cell stress, cell death responses. And interestingly, we see very similar patterns with our autopsy studies of COVID-19, lungs filled with neutrophils, upregulation of neutrophilic inflammatory responses, and so on. So there does seem to be a link between the basic pathophysiology of the primary viral infection between 1918 and COVID-19, which we're exploring. Matter of fact, an important point here is that if you treat mice with a lethal dose of the 1918 virus, but treat half of them with a drug that blocks the formation of free radical oxygens, a key part of the neutrophil response, this is a drug that has no effect on the virus. Virus replication is not attenuated at all. These animals that are treated all survive and have very limited pneumonia, but have 10 to the 8th titers of virus in their lungs, but don't die. And the mice that don't get treated die. So it's not the virus infection alone. It's clearly a huge impact of the host inflammatory response that actually is an immunopathogenic response and is toxic. And we're seeing very similar things with COVID. And so we think that developing drugs like this that could selectively target, very carefully target parts of the inflammatory pathway might be useful to treat these severe infections. So we'll look briefly at viral factors. Now, summarize about 10 years of work on this slide, that there's not a single mutation that accounts for the the extreme virulence of the 1918 flu. It's polygenic, that is, it's made up mutations in more than one of the genes of the eight gene segments of the 1918 virus. But the bulk of the virulence is due to the gene that encodes the major surface protein of the virus called hemagglutinin. And we thought for sure that because it looked very much like a bird virus and there were just a small number of changes from typical bird H1 hemagglutinins, that we would then be able to map why the 1918 virus behaved this way. And so when we made 1918 virus but swapped in just regular modern bird H1 genes into these constructs, they still killed mice just like 1918 with this neutrophilic infiltrate. And what we tried this again and again and again, and we swapped parts of the new, and we finally conclude that there's no mutation in the 1918 virus that makes it so virulent. It's that the 1918 virus just happened to express an avian hemagglutinin that in a bird is not pathogenic at all, but when expressed in the context of a virus that can replicate efficiently in a mammal, induces this kind of pre-inflammatory response. So this means that that a future pandemic derived from an H1 subtype bird pandemic could have exactly the same devastating effect as 1918. Worse is that when we looked at then substituting every single type of hemagglutinin from birds into this construct, you find that of the 16 subtypes of hemagglutinin that you find in birds, several of them give rise to this this very, very pathogenic formula, including H1s, but also H7s, H10s, that induce this kind of pro-inflammatory response. And you know, I've been very concerned since the last 9 or 10 years about H7 infections. This is one of the subtypes that has these similar features. These viruses are similarly pathogenic in our experimental models. And so if H7 or H6 or H10, which have all infected animals in the wild and all have infected humans over the last 10 years or so, if one of these viruses were to adapt to cause a pandemic, I would expect that you would see a severe pandemic. And so these are the reasons that we think we could help narrow the search for pandemic ancestors and concentrate on some of these subtypes. Lastly, to mention secondary bacterial pneumonias, a super important issue in 1918. Here you can see gram stains of 1918 autopsy tissues just full of gram-positive bacteria, either it was strep pneumonia or staphylococcus or a group A strep. And of course, this was appreciated in 1918. There were a number of bacterial vaccines made. They actually had some efficacy to prevent bacterial pneumonia. Not the viral pneumonia, but they prevented the bacterial pneumonia. Here's the mayor of Boston being inoculated. And very recently, from the Library of Congress in the United States, we had donated to our lab a little wooden box about the size of a matchbox with these three little glass vials of a 1918 bacterial vaccine. And using our technique, we're now sequencing the complete genomes of the bacteria that were used in this vaccine, which is another story and quite interesting. But to make a very, very long set of experiments short, the virus does a lot of damage, plus the host inflammatory response, and then it damages the lung such a way to set you up for a secondary infection, and that's sort of the final straw. So it's sort of this perfect storm, and the interaction between the virus infection and the bacteria infection, to use sort of colloquial terms, really irritates neutrophils, and it makes them more express more radical oxygen, do more damage, bystander damage to epithelial and endothelial cells. And one of the unique consequences of a 1918 infection, never seen in any other influenza infection, is the widespread formation of these blood clots or thrombosis in the lung, widely reported by pathologists in 1918. Here's a 1918 autopsy with such a thrombus. And we can model this in animals. And in the case of the 1918, this kind of widespread thrombosis requires both the virus and the secondary bacterial infection. In COVID autopsies, we saw lots, and other people around the world have seen lots of pulmonary thrombosis, coagulopathies being a huge problem. And interestingly, there look to be similarities in the way this is forming. And so again, we think that if we can find the similar pathways of how the 1918 virus induced thrombosis and COVID, that you might be able to think of ways to intervene in these coagulopathies, regardless of whether it's an influenza or a coronavirus outbreak. So in the last minute, I just want to say, what can we do about this in addition to therapeutics and basic understanding? So one of the things that has engaged many people for many years is this idea of making a vaccine that would be protective of more than just one strain, right? So you're familiar that every single year you have to get your updated influenza shot because the virus is evolving every year and mutating, and so you make a matched vaccine. So what we're trying to do is come up with ways to make a vaccine that would provide broader protection and perhaps quote-unquote universal protection against any HA and NA subtype combination. So there are 144 different subtype combinations of virus seen in birds. And we have a vaccine that's a very simple idea. It's based on a whole inactivated virus of a combination of four low-path avian viruses that are chemically inactivated, and this can be vaccinated both intramuscularly or intranasally. And we see very, very good protection against lethal dose challenges from viruses that are not in the vaccine at all. So it is really providing what looks like very broad protection in mice and ferrets and other animals. What you see is a complete mitigation against the development of pneumonia in the vaccinated animals. The lung fields are clear. There's practically no virus left after vaccination, even for subtypes that are completely foreign to the vaccine, like the 1957 H2 or H10. There's little to no inflammatory response. This is all in ferrets. And now, while this was delayed for 3 years because of COVID, we now have the initial phase one of this study in humans, the first human study of this vaccine candidate at the NIH in my group. And that phase one trial is now fully enrolled. We're still blinded to that, but they've been groups vaccinated with either placebo or the vaccine intramuscularly, intranasally. This is not for efficacy. This is just for safety and immunological studies. But then what we hope is to be moving on shortly to efficacy studies in phase two studies, and probably we would facilitate using a challenge model in which volunteers could be safely and ethically challenged with some circulating H1 and H3 viruses of different flavors, and could be evaluated whether this vaccine provides cross-protective evaluation. And these studies could help us design better vaccines and to study the correlates of immunity. So this is a very, very brief summary of what we've been doing over the decades to think about the 1918 flu and its relation to future pandemics and its strange correlations with the COVID autopsy. So I will stop at this point and thank the members of my group and our funding from the National Institutes of Health, but also from the Defense Department, DARPA, and for some of it for BARDA, another part of the U.S. government. And the universal flu vaccine work that I was describing at the end has been heavily funded by a very gracious gift from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So I thank you for your attention.
Questions from the audience.
Is this working now? It does.
Thank you for a very nice talk. I very much enjoyed your complete overview from the very start until now. So I was thinking of your recent work on the vaccine that you said were offering broad protection after vaccination with four different subtypes inactivated virus. I was wondering if you could say something about the assumed mechanism of action, what type of immunity would actually do that?
Yes. Thank you for the question. It's a very good question. The concept of a whole inactivated virus is obviously a 70-year-old technology. It's not modern or doesn't sound fancy at all. I mean, it's not mRNA or ferritin nanoparticle or anything. But what you have are sets of complete viruses. We use BPL inactivation rather than formalin, so it doesn't cross-link the proteins. The hemagglutinin is still active. The neuraminidase is still active. It's just the virus can't replicate. Most of the mutations are in the RNA. So especially intranasally, these viruses are taken up in a sense and are in a sense really extremely attenuated viruses. They don't, because the RNA doesn't replicate, you don't get an interferon response, but you get processing of viral proteins and presentation in class one. We see antibodies being made against the four hemagglutinin heads, the hemagglutinin stalks, the neuraminidase. We see T cell responses to nuclear protein, PB1, and so on. So I think that this approach gives you a very blended immune response. We think that one advantage of that is that we found in our immunologic studies in people is that not everyone responds to influenza infection the same way. Some people, in our challenge studies where we very carefully analyze and screen patients before challenge, and we know when challenge is at time zero. We look at their titers of their different antibodies, and we follow them when their viral infection occurs and how they clear and what happens, and look at VDJ rearrangements and so on. And we find that some people get infected and make super high hemagglutinin antibody titers, and it comes down, and some people clear the virus and make super high neuraminidase titers but never make high antibody titers, and this is crazy. But obviously the genetics are different and SNPs are different. So we think that a vaccine that would provide immunity in all sorts of different directions would be the best approach. I mean, it's a sort of stupidly simple idea, but it turns out the immunology is not simple. We still don't have a full answer of what's happening, but we know that it's both T cell and humorally mediated. And we think that the advantage of the mucosal delivery is that it's delivering these responses, to the immune system rather than systemically, although systemically does work.
Then I understand it's presumably your efficacy is due to strain-specific antibodies against HA or NA, and that you have the combination that will enable you to actually protect against a variety of strains rather than actually inducing something that is by nature broadly,
yes.
Neutralizing for example.
Right. So the stock antigens would obviously be conserved. We have both a group 1 and group 2. We chose 4 hemagglutinins to represent the phylogenetic distance of the 16 hemagglutinin subtypes. They're 2 group 1s, 2 group 2s, H1 and H3 because they've caused pandemics in people in the past, H5 and H7 because they are threat pandemics. But we find that it's not a miraculous combination. You can make other subtypes. We also find that passive serum transfer with antibody to animals who have not been vaccinated but then challenged can be saved if the subtype matches the vaccine, but not in a heterocyptic challenge. So you need a T cell response for the heterocyptic challenge. It's really not antibody.
So I have a question. It was really interesting to hear you talk about the pathogenesis of the 1918 flu. And pointing out that there are a lot of similarities between COVID-19 and the 1918 flu, particularly this excessive inflammation and thrombotic events in the lungs. But I'm curious to know, why did people die from the bacterial infection in 1918 and not so much now?
Yeah.
As I have understood this, people died quite quickly from the flu at the time, so they had 3 or 4 days and then they were dead. And we have had patients in hospitals for weeks, and I don't think bacteria has been such a big problem.
Yes, no, there's excellent questions. So in 1918, there are certainly lots of sort of anecdotal reports of people, feeling ill and getting on a tram line, and by the time they got to their stop, they were dead. And these things certainly may have occurred, but in general, the average time from symptom onset to death was 12 days. In 1918, which was exactly the same as the 2009 pandemic. Influenza virus infection peaks at sort of 2 to 4 days after infection. Most of the people who died, even in 1918, probably didn't have any active viral infection going on. They had the secondary bacterial infections. One thing, and I agree that we have seen far fewer secondary bacterial pneumonias in COVID than we expected to see. I mean, we do see them, but in our autopsy studies, many of them have been, ventilator-acquired infections and not the kind of standard gram-positive pneumonias that you would have seen in 1918. One thing that we think is interesting and different between 1918 and COVID, I didn't have time to discuss, is that while the 1918 virus clearly can replicate in respiratory epithelial cells from the trachea down to airway epithelial cells in the alveoli, the superficial cells of the respiratory epithelium, the tracheobronchial tree, the ciliated mucosal cells, they are infected with virus and die, but the basal cells, which are the sort of local stem cells that reproliferate, do not die. They're actually not able to be infected with virus, and you can grow normal human respiratory epithelial cells in culture at the air-fluid interface and infect them with virus, and you see the same thing. Whereas with COVID, those basal cells were themselves also infected, and so with the 1918, it requires the secondary bacterial infection to kill those cells. It probably exposes novel binding sites for these bacteria that then can invade the lung. And so in both cases, though, a key feature is a lack of ability to repair your lung epithelium because you've lost the stem cells that make it necessary. So why, you know, so the explanation for the why the bacterial relationship in 1918, not in COVID, is that in COVID, the virus seemed to be able to induce this lethal pneumonia by itself, where in 1918, it seems to require the secondary bacterial infection. And of course, we're very biased in our autopsy studies because we're only looking at dead people, right? I mean, you know, so in 1918, the vast majority of people who got sick, recovered, no antibiotics, no antivirals, no vaccines, nothing, right? So maybe they were only mildly ill, maybe they were very ill, but they recovered. Of course, we can never examine the tissues of the people who, you know, only recovered, right? So we're biased. We tend to think, oh, this is what all the infections look like, but, right, it's a very tiny percentage of the cases that had this extreme fatality, exactly just like in COVID-19. So, you know, you have to be very careful not to think that what we're seeing is, you know, the way everyone's going to react, right? These are those small people, small numbers of people who have this unfortunate outcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Tallenberger. I work in the National Influenza Center in Norway, and great. It's been great to listen to you today, and also great to watch the progress of your work. And it's amazing how much we have learned about the 1918 virus, but there is still quite a lot that we don't know. And one of the mysteries is the difference in the outcome of the three main waves of the Spanish influenza. And the question remains, I think, was it something that was different with the virus in the different waves, or was there some other factor that was different? And from the sequences that you know, those sequences, they are not very different from each other. So,
no.
Could I invite you to speculate a little on this?
Yes. So, thank you for that very excellent set of questions. The hemagglutinin sequences we have from these early spring summer waves are really very, very close to what we see in the fall wave and the one third wave case we have in February. The only characteristic difference between all of these hemagglutinins is a single mutation in the receptor binding domain. That the 1918 cases differ from the classic avian influenza viruses by two mutations in the receptor binding domain, which switches the affinity of the virus from the more bird-like alpha 2-3 sialic acids to the more human-preferred alpha 2-6 sialic acids. Whereas some of the spring wave cases, and also strangely the most latest case, the fall wave case that we have, I mean the February 1919 case from London, has only one change that has a kind of a blended receptor specificity. It's sort of half avian, half human. It's sort of in between. But we find that in binding to human tracheal epithelial cells in culture, that whether it has an avian receptor binding, the halfway, or the full human type receptor, no mutations, one mutation, two mutation, they all equally infect these cells. And we know that the virulence of the 1918 hemagglutinin, when it's expressed on a seasonal flu background or any other viral background just by itself, is pathogenic and is not related to the receptor binding. So my thinking is that the 1918 virus was pathogenic from the get-go because of its avian hemagglutinin, but that when it started to emerge, I mean, you know, think about it. So I mean, the way that the pandemic emerged, we're never going to know exactly when and how it emerged because it was all under the radar. And you know, here's an extremely pathogenic virus, but at its peak was killing about 1-2% of the population. If you have just a small number of cases and it emerges in the the year before flu season, and where we're already expecting pneumonia and influenza mortality, and you have a small number of cases, it's very hard epidemiologically, clinically, to notice it's something different. And just like 2009, I think in the summer is just a bad time for flu to circulate for reasons that we all still don't really understand. And then the fall occurs, and the virus was globally distributed. So I can't really explain the wave pattern. I can say that the wave pattern was not consistent globally. And as we've seen in COVID, and that we can't really explain that. There were prominent third waves in some American cities and not in other American cities. London and Paris differed very greatly in their pattern in the third wave and yet very close together. So these are mysteries that we still can't explain, but I don't think so far that there's real evidence that the virulence changed from the different waves, if that answers the question, or my best attempt at answering the question.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. I have a question from the veterinary side. the influenza viruses are on birds. They seem to be more stable than they are in mammals. Do you know if mutations you found in the hemagglutinin of the 1918 viruses, if they are still around are they found in the surveys that have been done for avian influenza?
Well, thank you for the question. And the inherent genetic instability and error rate between avian flu viruses and those adapted to mammals is the same, but I think the biological, or let's put it this way, the ecological pressures on these viruses are very different. In birds, you know, it's a segmented virus, and so if one animal is infected with two different flu subtypes at the same time, you can mix and match the genes and create new subtype combinations with new H's and N's. So rather than undergo antigenic drift in a kind of a linear way like human viruses do, or viruses adapted to pigs or horses, where you can look at how the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase escape antibodies and mutate every year, the hemagglutinins and neuraminidases within birds tend to be rather stable, because instead of drifting, they just swap out new hemagglutinins. We don't think that there are any mutations in the 1918 hemagglutinin that differ from modern avian H1s that you could find in a duck pond here. If we take a modern human modern avian H1 right out of a wild bird, no mammalian adaptation, you know, just take it directly and make the synthetically make the sequence and insert it onto a construct that can replicate in a mammal, it behaves like the 1918 virus. So I think that's the scary thing, but it also leads to another really important question. You know, if H1s and H7s and H10s and so have these pathogenic features, why don't we have pandemics all the time? You know, so we still don't understand this leap to go from an avian-adapted virus to, a mammalian-adapted virus. And luckily for all of us, it clearly is something that doesn't happen very often, and it must be very difficult.
One last quick question before we move on.
It's often suggested that a particular age distribution, kind of mortality, might be due to the older people having some immunity from the so-called Russian flu, if that was flu. Do you think that you may, at least to some extent, explain this W curve?
No, thank you for the question. The W curve is still incredibly perplexing. I think that there is clear, very clear data that the very elderly, especially people over about 80, had what looks like protection in 1918. That is, they had lower influenza mortality in the pandemic than was seen in the, say, 10 years of seasonal flu prior to that in that age group. I do not think that is from the 1889 so-called Russian flu pandemic, if it was influenza. There is also some speculation that maybe this was a coronavirus pandemic, although there are no isolates, so we can't know. Serology is very difficult to interpret. But there was an influenza pandemic in the 1830s that was rather severe. So we might speculate that the 1830s pandemic may have been an H1, that the 1889-1890 pandemic has been variously speculated based on serology to either be H2 or H3. It's difficult to know. So it could be that people who were born sometime before 1889, especially as they went back in time closer to the 1830s, definitely had something that gave them cross immunity with the 1918, and that could be a component of that. So going backward in time would be extremely valuable. Finding 1889 material or pre-1918 seasonal influenza autopsy material is critically important for molecular analysis. I don't know how far backward in time, you know, we could go with sampling and so on, but we may never be able to answer these questions. As I alluded at the beginning, we know the genetics of four influenza pandemics, which, you know, is a span of 150 years for us, but it's not much time in the span of how viruses evolve and interact with humans. And so if you do an experiment, N equals four is a small number. There's a quote from the Dutch influenza virologist Herz, who said that he only wishes that influenza virologists could live to about 200 years so that they could see what happens to their hypotheses. So I still think that's a very valuable advice.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Memo. Thank you.
And thank you so much, Dr. Todd Berger. I'd like to welcome the next speaker, which is
Professor John, Oxford. The floor is yours, and just start whenever you're ready.
Sven, ladies and gentlemen, can I first of all say how pleased I am to be here. We've got used to Norway with my family. We used to come and see Lars Horheim, I think, when he was working here years ago as a virologist, and then he moved to Bergen, and then we switched our allegiance from Oslo to Bergen. But we've got used to the cheese, we've got used to the alcohol crossing the line, we've got used to the Christmas thing we put an almond in it, and we've got used to all those things from Norway. So it's all very nice. It's particularly, I think, lovely for me to be here in this room. And what I love about this room is Nansen. And I'll come back to him, if I remember, I'll come back to him right at the end. I view him as an internationalist, otherwise he wouldn't have formed the League of Nations or helped so much for the League of Nations from Norway here. I think he would be thinking about him now, and I was thinking about it just at the end of Jeffrey's talk, he would love to be here for this, and he'd love the students here, the age of the students, the idea of having international students here focused on an international problem. So I'm sure that Nansen will be very pleased to be involved in this sort of get-together. So that's why I think it's a rather special lecture room. Now, let's move forward with my own talk here. I'm going to start with a family picture. And this is not going to be full of family snaps. It's just going to be this one at the beginning to orientate me and to orientate you. I want to get you back to 1916. And Jeffrey's already mentioned the possibility, more than the possibility, I think, that the virus, there's several strands of evidence telling us that this virus emerged before 1918. And there's, I'm going to put it to you that it could have emerged as early as 1915, 16, or 17. And it's quite important to work out with the evolution of these pandemics, how long, if we can work it out, how long they take to evolve and get going. So it's an important thing to, I think, that 19, the Spanish flu, as it were, can help us sort it out. So 1916 anchors me, because this is my father. He was volunteering in 1916. And you'll see he's got a white hat on, that's a Navy hat. He's got on his signal here is a flying thing. In fact, he volunteered for Kitchener's army, Kitchener being the main general in Britain for the land army. He volunteers for Kitchener's army and finds himself in the Royal Naval Air Force, in the part of the aircraft thing of the Royal Naval Air Force. So you can volunteer for one thing and end up with three other things piled on top of that. Now, what he did not realise, and what no one else realised apart from a few pathologists and clinical doctors working in France, and working in near London as well, that something was happening, some infection was happening on the Western Front, and they picked, and also in London, outskirts of London, they began to pick this infection up, certainly in the end of 1916, possibly a little bit before. And we've got some new information I'll briefly allude to today. We've concentrated on, my students did all this, looking for early outbreaks. That's what we focused on it. Let's look in the literature. But of course, if you put flu in the literature, you've got a problem, because before 1918, it was hardly ever called influenza. The infection was called epidemic bronchitis, or purulent bronchitis, or every other little thing, but not influenza so much. It's only after 1918 that flu became. So if you search for flu earlier, you won't find it. What you have to do is go through the journals. And that's what they did, page by page. And they came up with this top one here, Hammond, Rowland, and Shaw. And you'll see it's heavily censored. And I know that we've been talking about American Army didacting, whatever it's called. You kind of wipe things out of my own army and all this other stuff in modern terms. But they were at it in 1918 as well. We know, in fact, one of the reasons we think that things called Spanish flu is because of censorship. In the British and from Britain, censorship from France, and censorship from Germany. But I didn't really think we'd stumble on it in our own research, but here it is, a first example of it applied to medical things. But I think the censors are going to have to contend with these people, not necessarily Hammond, and we're doing research on this. My collaborator here is a medical historian, and he focuses on that particularly, and I concentrate on the rest. But we're going to get deeper into it. But we think there's a lot of interest here. But the main thing I'm saying, they can be combative, these people. And I want to say one other thing about moving you back to 1916. It's definitely a lot different from what it is today. You're an impoverished nation here. You just had farming, and beautifully illustrated in that painting up there, it was all farm. It was poor, fish, farm, poor fish. There was nothing really here compared to a superpower like Britain. Britain was the superpower of the world, the biggest navy, the biggest army, the biggest everything, the biggest scientific expertise, the biggest medical expertise in the world was sitting there in the empire, the British Empire. And when this war started, half of it was moved across the Channel to France. So half the total medical expertise in Britain, half the nursing expertise in Britain was moved across into France. So suddenly in France, in a very small area at the top of France, you've got half the medical staff, you've got 180,000 beds. That's about the size of the National Health Service today, roughly. They constructed them along the Western Front to deal with the casualties. And my goodness, did they have those casualties. Sometimes in one camp that we looked at, maybe six trains a day with 1,000 wounded soldiers would come in. 6,000. Now, my big hospital, Royal London, they couldn't cope. These days, there were more than 100 people coming in. They could hardly cope with the Moorgate disaster, let alone 6,000 coming in. So it gives you a touch, I think, of what they're up against. It's just not, you know, it's just very, very abnormal. They did appreciate, awesomely, this lot, especially the authors down the bottom here, are much more high-powered. The top ones, apart from Shaw, the top two are more or less general practitioners in the army. But the rest of them are high-powered, I can tell you that. So I want to give you the correct feeling about the knowledge behind these papers. The senior paper, the senior author Herbert French. I mean, he was professor at the Guy's Hospital, and he was trained at my own hospital, the Royal London, or called the London Hospital in those days. But he was soon to become physician to the King, and he wrote half of the report, the government's report of the 1918 pandemic. He wrote the classic book, which is still in extant, about differential diagnosis, and he'd done all that before these papers came out. And I'll tell you something for free now before we get to it. This paper, they all agreed here that something's happening in 1916, 1917, but they were shy about the use of the word influenza. They were shy about the word, using the word epidemic, and that's why they get through the censor, I think. But by the time 1919 came, they were out of censorship, weren't they? The war ended. So they banged in this lot, this group here, Herbert French's, who got in a massive publication, which everyone looks at the pictures, and I'll show you in a moment what those pictures are. But he says in that paper, we're fed up with telling people this outbreak started 2 years ago. In it was called something slightly different, but that's when it started. So you've got it from the horse's mouth, from a high-powered team. And the other ones, Eyre, Hallows, and Abrahams, were not normal hospital doctor, army doctors. They were not surgeons. They were not cutting off wounded people's legs. They were planning. And then to contend with everything, to contend with this idea of not wanting the British Army wiped out as they were in South Africa, or with against the Russians in Crimea, they had high-powered people like Leishman, Leishman of leishmaniosis. Moving up and down the Western Front, looking at hygiene. Anyone there in that thing, they could never, the biggest memory was disinfective with chlorinated tea. Everything was chlorinated. So they did their best, they really did their best to contend with what they thought was going to go on. This is the kind of the 1919 paper that everyone looks at the pictures and don't read the text. But these are the phases of this heliotrope cyanosis. So Jeffrey's mentioned a characteristic signature of the 1918 pandemic. The signatures are two things, the age, the young age range of people dying, and the other signature is this heliotrope cyanosis. You can see, if you look at the top one, it's not all that much, apart from the eyes slightly drooping, and this is a very famous artist doing these three. Continue that. The heliotrope, this lavender coloration, is seen on the face in the middle one, and by the third stage, these are getting worse and worse and worse, by the time you get to the second stage, they're not going to survive. Certainly not by the third stage. They could sometimes survive from the first case, from the first picture onwards. So heliotrope cyanosis is a signature of that outbreak. So if you're looking for early outbreaks or anything else, you need those two things. Otherwise, you don't believe it. You do not believe people saying they're dying. You've got to show that they're dying in youth is involved, and the heliotrope in some sort of way is involved. And then you can be more sure of a description of an outbreak. Douglas is particularly, I say, we worked at Etaples, followed up. He's went in the last 4 years, he's gone through 30,000 death certificates, and more than 30,000 clinical records to try and reconstruct the whole, we're trying to reconstruct what happened at the, in these great camps. There are not many people dying in those early days. You know, you might get six. In that camp of Etaples, which I'll show you a picture of in a moment, and there were 100,000 soldiers were in that, and they had 30,000 beds in that camp. So small way, with all that going on, I've got huge admiration for these groups, picking out this infection. I can just imagine what reception they got from most of those doctors there, that they were totally wasting their time, that they should be spending all their time cutting off people's legs. That would have been the reception, because surgeons were always top of the pile. Medical pathologists were always dropped down on the pile. I bet they had a hell of a time trying to get their point across. But this is a numbers game, which are quite small, but we're now finding same numbers, the same death certificates, the same pathology in the other camps at Rouen, which is 20 miles away from Etaples, from another camp at Boulogne, which is about 50 or 60 miles away, and we're also finding it in other places along that western France. So we're thinking it's much more widespread. There's a typical picture of Etaples. Do not think it's like a Boy Scouts camp. I mean, this is 100,000 soldiers. It's called the worst place on earth. Some of the famous poets were there, described it in terrible terms, because people were, their decisions were wiped, they could be wiped out. This is 30 miles away from the Western Front. If the decision to let them go home, they'd be saved. If the decision was more often, getting back to the front, we're not maligned people, we're not malingerers here. So those are tough times, something that was very difficult now to appreciate. And you could say, well, hearing Jeffrey's talk, all right, we're talking about an avian virus, we're talking about migratory birds, we're talking about geese. Well, show me the evidence that those soldiers in the camp have anything to do with geese. And I'll just show you this one. I can show you ones in the plucking geese, feeding geese, doing all kinds of things, probably eating geese as well. But this is the goose area of France, which I'm talking about here. There it is. A small area, you can see England in the top left-hand corner there. We're not far, you know, it's 20 miles away across the channel. There's a small area. That's the Western Front, that deep red line. That's 10 miles. So the firing, killing zone, was about 10 miles on either side of the trench. That's about as far as the big guns could hit with any degree of accuracy. But most of the killing was in that system there. And the wounded and anyone who got infected were transported by train back to the camps where all the beds were, where Etaples was, and Etaples somewhere there. The whole show was organised by the army from Montreuil here as well. Down here, Paris, you see the small parties of France. Paris is down here somewhere, Rouen's down here somewhere, Boulogne's up here. But that, all along here, particularly, their descriptions are you go there by boat and all you can see are white tents. And that's because there's 180,000 beds in the units along there. So we're talking about spillover. That's the word that you've got and appreciate. It's a very good term, I think, rather than emerging these viruses. They're spilling over from a bird or plus a pig, but we think now with the 1918 bird, it's spilling over from one to the other. We've already heard about the lessons, and I'll come to our end of what we want to deduce from these pandemics as we prepare for the next one. It might seem very surprising to you all that here we are, we're not even over the one we're into in the moment, but we're thinking about how we're going to stop or help with the next one. No, we've got to do that. We've got to do that. That's where Amundsen, I want to pull into Amundsen, but here we are. 1916, 145 deaths. 1918, 80 million. COVID, 2019, one death. 2022, 16 million. They're not slow. And we've got to appreciate that, otherwise we're never going to get anywhere with this. And the moment governments do not appreciate that, my own government, they couldn't care less about speed. No one took any action for months with all this thing was going along with COVID. Something is seriously wrong with the preparations and with the plans that were not used, and we cannot have that happening again. And if I've got time, I'll come back to that at the end. You might ask me, all right, are you saying then that this virus spilt over, the 1918 one, spilt over 2 years before in 1916 in the armies and the army camps, all that? And I'm saying yes. And you can say, well, why didn't it spread? And I think that's the other thing that put off some of those authors who are being more overt. Their duty, their duty as doctors and scientists was to inform people that there's a great threat coming along. You've already mentioned the 1889 pandemic, and some of them would have experienced it or been taught by people who did. They could not hold back if they thought they were dealing with the early events of another pandemic. They could not just cover it up. That would be unethical to do that. So they had to kind of resolve this difficult thing, I think, in their own minds. Should they spill the beans, what they really thought? Should they cover it up to get it published? What? It was very difficult, I think, to be in their position. But the outlet, there was an outlet. If you were in the army, and my father was in the Royal Naval, he couldn't come back to England. He was stuck there. You were the volunteers. You had your chips. You were stuck there. He was stuck there on a little air. I know exactly where he was, near a Taplon, a little airfield, probably not much bigger than 10 times bigger than this room. They could not come back to England. So there's a very precious little movement. So that's one reason why I think there's not the compacted things. There's not much movement. But there was movement here, going to the United States. And it was a loud movement because the Boston Medical School, the university there, came up with a joint affair with Oxford University to allow doctors and nurses to volunteer to come to Etaples and help out before America joined the war. This is before America even joined the war. By 1915, these doctors and nurses were going backwards and forwards, and they went on six-month contracts. So they'd come and work at Etaples. If they survive, they can go home, they come back again, they're backwards and forwards. So in a sense, you can view it as they were backwards and forwards between from the epicenter, and I'm saying this is an epicenter, I think, from everything adding up, to Boston, back to, and then more volunteers started coming from other medical schools outside Boston. There's a snapshot. We were talking about naming people. I know who all these people are, and I was going to show it today with names, and I thought I'd better not, because we're not saying, this is a passenger list. And those are some of the boats, and those are the dates. And we know that hospital doctors and nurses, the American ones, were moving from Etaples when the outbreak was going on, the small outbreak was going on. But they would have been involved in it or heard about it, two of them got infected. And then they're going back to the States. And you think the hypothesis is they could have transported it back unknowingly. And I don't want to put the names on because I don't want anyone to start saying, well, you're accusing my relative of starting a pandemic which spread around the world and killed 100 million people. It's best to keep away from people's names. But a goodly mixture of very nice people volunteered, and we're thinking that inadvertently that could have been a transport way to make the virus international. It's very difficult to get hospital data from the French, because you could say, well, we're locals. Could locals get infected from? Well, the trouble is, there were military zones. This is a bit of England, a big piece of England, in French territory. And it was all, you could not just walk out of it or walk into it. So it's very strict control of anyone in those, anyone. So 1.2 million British troops, maybe 200,000 or 300,000 in the hospital setup. They could not walk out into the local countryside. They could not. So there were opportunities where the virus could not spread easily because of those things. Now, where did it come from? Jeffrey's alluded to it in a way. We're thinking still that these viruses evolve, if you like, in China, in a saltwater lake here in the Tibet part of China, and they migrate in huge numbers. There's a huge mixing area. We know, everyone knows that. And the migration normally, we were talking about beforehand, normally north-south, but you're never pretty sure with these migrations. Sometimes they don't migrate at all. I remember going to an EU thing in the last year, and they were tracking migrating birds, but some of them didn't move from this area because they were sitting by a warm chimney in some factory. They decided to stick it out. And you can't be sure of these migrations. You only need one infected one to do something strange, then you've got a strange a consequence, but mainly north-south. So they're mainly here, moving northwards, and for some reason they are moving across westwards, across the great expanses here, hitting Scandinavia, coming down across here, hitting England, here, coming down to Etaples, across the western part of France, where all this Picardy, all the geese are, coming down, and where these camps are, coming down through Spain, and going over to Africa. So we think that a spillover happened at Etaples. Where are we? There. And then we know now that there's transports going backwards and forwards, even totally unexpectedly since the war was on, and they were threatened, those boats were sinking, and then we know with Lusitania it was sunk. So it's not an easy decision if you're a doctor or a nurse, to volunteer for this, or I'm going to go back to America, you go back on a ship that was, could be sunk by the Germans. So they're all difficult decisions all the time, but there were plenty moving backwards and forwards, 350 we know anyway, over that period of time, moving backwards and forwards to mainly on the east parts of the United States, but sometimes a bit deeper into the United States. This is the quote from the powerful group from London. Once again, and even at the risk of becoming monotonously insistent, we would emphasize our view that in the essential, the influenza, pneumococcal infection, bronchitis, in inverted commas, that we and others described in 1916-17 is the same condition as the influenza pneumonia of the present pandemic. Now, Crosby, whose book we all read, he insisted in that book that if you're going to go look for an origin of flu in 1984, you've got to have a scientific group authorizing it. And then he goes and disbelieves it, sticks out of order of his own suggestion, because he went and had the theory that it started in the United States, and there's no scientific publication of that little outbreak. It's just hearsay, basically. So here we have a major group here making a comment about it, and now we've got, in a sense, I'm more polite than Olson, but Olson in his group, and I think Simonson's in your group, I think I saw a name in partly in here, he says the Kansas hypothesis is lacking in vigorous evaluation. That's a polite way of putting it in scientific. In other words, it's concocted or faked, not faked, but just total muddle up, really, and not worth bothering about. And then he says, these findings, he suggests, reopen the possibility that the virus had spread from Europe to New York in the context of troop movements during World War I. Because he's describing here an early outbreak, and he's identified it by the thing, what's the age group of people dying? And it's a young age group. And he's picking this up over that winter of 1917 to 1918. So I think the evidence is strong, I think, now, of an emergence spillover in Europe. Certainly not this United States, certainly not this one, which he made so much of. And David Barry, I know David Barry, he's a very good writer. When you're a good writer, you can allude to things and convince people. And I read the book recently, and he even convinced me that it all started. He was so good as a writer, and he began quoting this sort of person. But I don't believe any of it now. And you have to take it with a pinch of salt, I think. On it. So let's go on to two other new things. This is a quote from Charles Dickens, The Best of Times, and I wanted to get the little thing in about your particular interest. I'm going to leave the origin, but I'll leave it with you that it started before 1918, probably in 16, in England, in Europe. I'm going to recall it something else. I'm going to call it the Spanish flu. I'm going to think we should call it the European flu. And we see how many problems there have been with COVID. Arguing. Is it the Spanish? You know, is it the Chinese flu? It's highly political, and that's why WHO resists the idea these days of naming any virus, even flu viruses, after where you pick them up because of this politics. And Jeffrey's alluded to that. So I think that. So I'm going to go for the European flu, I think. So the best of times and the worst of times, the season of light and the season of darkness, comes from the opening paragraph of Dickens' Tale of the Two Cities. And it's an important concept that even in the worst of times, there's some good times, and even in the bad times, you know, it's that point he made. And Grenfell was a medical doctor from my own hospital, and he became a missionary. And he was a favourite in the college. It became Grenfell, and he went to Labrador. And some of these early pictures, and I think you must have seen them before, coming out from Okak, there are other places, but there were, I suppose, a very well invested, just because a photographer was there, just before the 1918, a photographer was there, and took lots of pictures of this little community of 260 people. There's a typical sort of living accommodation there, all that family living there. This is a very important picture, and you'll see in a moment. And there's the single survivor, Arthur. And when I first started doing television, I had a knock on the door one day. It was a television company, and they said they got this amazing film. They don't know what to do with it. They bought it as a job lot from an American company, CBS or whatever it was. And perhaps I'd like to be cut into it, because I was a flu virologist, and to make sense of it. And it was her interview I was cut into. And she describes how she was a single survivor when she was 6 years old, when everything began to go awry. the influenza started in this community of 260 people, and then the young men particularly started dying, the 25-year-olds. Now, a community like that, we mentioned it earlier, depends on young men collecting wood every day. They sometimes had coal, and usually the boat brought coal, but I don't know how short they were that year. So wood and water, moving food around, carving up carcasses, which were frozen usually underneath little houses where they were living. And long and short of it was, the young people died, there was a shortage of water, a shortage of food, and then the dogs were not fed, and they attacked the humans. So she described it perfectly on the interview I did, was mixed in with her, what happened. That she was lying in the bed in the corner of a igloo, and the dogs would come in and eat her, they ate, tear people up and tear them and get them out. Now, she survived because the lead husky looked after her. And she had a packet of biscuits, or she had a tin of biscuits, and she would feed her brother, who was 2 years younger, I think, or a year younger. And they went on for 3 months like this, the pair of them. Unbeknownst to them, the sole survivors of this outfit, of this little township. And when the rescuers were very late on coming, they did arrive in the end, they came in, they shot any dog, they realised what had happened, because you see the people, half-eaten people all over the place. And they came in to burst into where she was, and they had a rifle, and they saw a movement, they were just about to shoot her, but they shot the husky who'd been defending her. So they killed their defending dog and almost killed her. And she was a single survivor. They and others, in all of this, she described how wonderful it always was living in that community. She said, "You hear that? My father started fishing, would move to another place. They were movement. Every 3 months, they were moving from place to place. They had their little setups. In the summer, they'd be whaling or sealing, and so on. So the whole year was structured. I can remember the times we used to cut the fish and dry it and then go out in the boat and then bake apples and blackberries. We'd come home and gather them aside. And it was a lovely time, a lovely time. So they were okay when things were okay. But obviously with these sorts of societies, if something goes wrong, they're nastily vulnerable. And I want to contrast that in a Dickensian way, which is why I put the thing, with at the same year, what was going on in England. In a fairly working class community in Wales, a little place, I know, Mold it's called, there it is, it's highly organised, you've even got a chemist shop here. It's so, so different. And as the letters are coming, I'll just show them, one from Gwendolyn. Gwendolyn was 23, and she could write every day. She could write a letter, and she did. My secretary typed this up, and I've got the original letter, writing to a mother. "Thank you so much for your letters." She's writing, the mother gets the letter the same day. This is how organized Britain was as a superpower at that time. Send a letter, get it, post it, and it arrives to another village about a couple of miles, and post it on the same day. And this is the letters that are going backwards and forwards. "Look, we're having a lovely time. I'm not feeling all that well. I've got a cough, and Dad's coughing as well. But I think we're going to be all right. Are you all right? Is everything all right with you, Mum?" But 2 days later, she's dead. That's the point. So I think you have to, Geoffrey mentioned this idea of people dying in the streets. I think most people died quietly at home. There's no indication of any real upset here. They just quietly passed on, I think. And with the hospitals blocked up with wounded, they couldn't take them in hospital. But another thing is, in this letter, she's saying, the doctor's coming every day. Now, how about that? You kind of get a doctor coming every day in England in the year 2022. And this is 1918, in the middle of a pandemic. So they were kind of looked after, and it was a whole different scene. I also, now, finally, I want to take another point here. And this is, Jeffrey's mentioned the 1889 pandemic. This is painted by Gauguin about that same time. Now, whether he knew, he was in the South Sea, whether he knew about the pandemic or not, I don't know. But this is a great scientific painting, the painting he loved of all his work. And he's written a thing across. I've chopped it off, actually, the top left-hand corner. It goes across it, and I've had it off. But it's, who are we, where are we, where are we going? Where have we come from, who are we, and where are we going? It's a great painting. It's a great painting. I'm not going to analyse the painting, but I just want to say one other thing about that, to put the whole context in a way. Who are we? Well, one way of looking at this is to say we only find out who we are when there's some calamity. And you can pick that up from Vera, if you want to. You can pick it up from Vera Brittain's book, Testament of Youth. She had not been on the Western Front, but she volunteered. Her family were middle class. She'd never seen blood in her life. She never had any activity in her life. Apart from being a student, they had servants that were all happy-go-lucky. And yet she volunteered and ended up at Etaples on the Western Front, at this awful place. So she wrote the poem, Epitaph on My Days in Hospital. That's Etaples. She wrote this in 1919. I found in you a holy place apart, sublime endurance, God in man revealed, where mending broken bodies slowly healed my broken heart. Now, her broken heart, her heart broke because her brother had been killed on the Western Front, and her fiancé had been killed on the Western Front. And on top of that, a week after all that information came through, the nursing sister came along to her and said, look, would you work on the German ward? No one wants to work on the German ward for obvious reasons. Your brother's been killed, but will you work on the German ward? And it was duty and honour, and she said yes, and she did, and she did. Now, let me get a different context finally here. And we've got to, I think, you might feel it's a ridiculous thing to say, and I've already been criticised by my own compatriots, to thinking out the next pandemic. And Geoffrey hasn't mentioned it, but there's an H5 virus moving around the whole of England, the whole of Europe, probably around you, and everyone's keeping quiet about it, I think. And I got jumped on at this meeting for mentioning the even fact that it could be pathogenic, could spread from a duck to a human or from a, you know. But it's all very well. We know the past, and this virus is much more widespread. And I've had a personal example. I went to see one of my own daughters, and a bird came out of the sky almost on top of me, hit me on the beach. So that's in Edinburgh. You can get virus-infected birds coming down all over the place at the moment, including swans. So I don't think it's an unusual situation by any means, and I think potentially dangerous situation. I was very surprised when I began to think, oh no, not another pandemic plan. And I looked, and I suddenly came across this one, and I thought, oh God, yeah, September 1993. And I realized I was a co-author of Britain's first pandemic plan. So I don't remember being a co-author of it, but here it is. I wasn't the first author. I've looked up the authors now, and I can see myself on it. I can't squeeze out of it. But it wasn't a bad plan. Only thing is, no one ever read it, because the director was Sir Joseph Smith, and he kept it in his cupboard, the pandemic plan. It was a five-page, six-page, but it was quite good. Inter-pandemic period, and then a phase one, emergence in some remote spot. Phase two, it is pandemic outside the UK. Phase three, isolated in the UK. Phase four, pandemic in the UK. End of pandemic, go back to square one, back to the beginning again. So, but it was quite a nice thing of what we would do. And I've been involved in lots of, I've never written one, apart from that one, help that one. I've contributed ideas and enthusiasm, and I have been enthusiastic, I still am enthusiastic about these pandemic plans. And I can tell you I was sick of them by 2009, having been to all around England. And Britain took notice of WHO, and they were asked to, every country was asked to make a plan, a pandemic plan. 155 countries in that days did, but some of them were just like two lines. Almost like the man who identified virus and influenza virus in the United States. He got one liner, you know. Three lines, just nonsense, really. The British one was 150 pages, and I think the American one was the same. The only thing is, all the recommendations weren't thought about. All the stocks of PPE, all the stocks of this and they were destroyed or got rid of by politicians. I'm sorry to say that. All the experts on public health, a lot of them were given the sack. It was all to do with austerity and economy. So I've learned something from that. It is that scientifically, we can spend our life planning these things. And if we hand it over to politicians, it's not safe. Something's gone wrong, seriously gone wrong. Not just in England, I think in other countries, possibly in the United States as well. So you can do all this work for a pandemic plan. Either no one reads it, or when they do read it, they don't bother about it. And then everything, when this pandemic started, I thought, well, that's going to be right. We've got the PPE stored away. Oh, no. Destroyed all that, couldn't be bothered, because it's expensive to keep it all going. So with the new pandemic plan, which we'll now have to get together, we're going to have to make sure, and it's already being discussed, we have to make sure that some high politician in every country is involved, so high that they can't destroy the wherewithal, that when we go to our next pandemic, we open up the cupboard and it's all there. Geoffrey had a picture of a vaccine from that time, and I've got this from the Royal College of Nurses. They let me actually pick it up and touch it. And he mentioned the 1889. Well, we've done a little study to see frozen samples from 1889. I was very pleased to see this one. I think you're some people here are co-authors of this archival material. I think this is the way to go. I'm very pleased. Now there are about 13 samples rather than two or whatever. So I think that's the way to go. And there's one other thing I want to say that no one's mentioned. So you, I think we have to confront this. This is the painter. I've not met him. It's called The Three Professors. It's exhibited at the National Gallery in Scotland. When I saw it, I thought, well, that's a strange. He's a professor of physiology, professor of anatomy, and a professor of biochemistry. Why are they skulking? Why do they look as though they're being hunted out? And I think myself, it's an anti-science painting. That's what they're saying. That's what, and the people can do this. They can paint things and not really know the implication of it. And now more and more, we have to contend not only with the politicians who are negligent, but we have to contend with people who are anti-science. And we have to be prepared to confront that when we get this next plan ready. And I got one other thing. When I come out of the Royal Land with the Barts, I sometimes think of John Donne. And he wrote this poem 400 years ago. Amundsen would like it. He would understand it because it's an international poem. Because the question, the heading, the title is "For Whom the Bell Tolls," and someone's asking the author, John Donne, you know, there's a bell ringing. Who's it ringing for? And he says, "It's ringing for you." And the reason is we're all in this together. That John Donne was an internationalist. If anyone was washed away, whether may thine friends are, each death, man's death, wherever it is, diminishes me. For I'm involved in mankind, therefore send not to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for you. So we're all in it together. We cannot be nationalistic. And there's a lot of nationalism crept into the pandemics. And finally, this is a kind of a typical view at the beginning of the war, that the soldier, and you see it's the beginning of the war because he's got a flat hat, when my father was there, he's standing, his friend's been shot. He's completely fearless. Why? Well, he's got an angel behind him to protect him. In fact, he's got two angels, and we all know that two angels are better than one. Sorry if you're very religious and I'm going to get criticised afterwards, but I've got a German counterpart to this, and sometimes they have three angels. So, you know, it's like that. So, finally then, pandemic window. I've mentioned Gauguin. We've got a pandemic window based on the Gauguin painting. It's the future. This one here. Let's go back again. On the right-hand side, that's science. The future is science. Here is the past with the pandemics, and there is the up and down. That's something we can't. It's to do with human nature. How are we going to react? But the future has to be science, and we really together. And I'm sure that Nansen would agree with this. We've got to be scientific. We've got to hold the science and not let these politicians run around saying they've talked to scientists. Make them tied down by it, and then the pandemic plan could work for the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Oxford. That OCAC history is like totally terrible as the ones on the other side of the continent. Yeah. 78% is, if I remember correctly, died in OCAC. And even that village of OCAC was, you know, closed down and abandoned, if I read the literature correctly. Mm. Totally bad.
Well, Martha was, the figures vary according to the reports. She is viewed as a single survivor, but I do see reading about it, the reports from the society, and their missionary society, not Grenfell's society, but another one, that the missionaries survived. Now, you really have to look at it carefully now, don't I dare look at it. Why would the missionaries survive and everyone else dead? Didn't the missionaries not help anyone? It's a bit tricky to work it out in some detail. I don't know what one would find if one did go into detail. Probably something you'd not like to see, I don't know. But they may have been older. That's one explanation. The missionaries may have been out of the age range. But as far as I can see, every Inuit thing died, regardless of age, because of the starvation. So presumably the missionaries were able to feed themselves and not get themselves involved in that. And get water, so they may have operated on a slightly different parallel universe.
So thank you for a very nice presentation. I wanted to get some thoughts from you on the potential of the H5 virus to cause the next pandemic.
Mm.
Because, well, even in Norway, we have a lot of cases where birds have H5 virus.
Yeah.
And you made a point that we should be prepared and we should take precautions fairly early on. But at the same time, we know that even though we have this influenza type in birds, it's a fairly big step for that influenza also to turn into a virus that can actually transmit between humans.
Yeah.
So at what stage should we really be worried and actually start making physical preparations? How should we think about that?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. It's not an easy question to answer. We were talking about it ourselves. The people who are working with it, I think there's a problem, a kind of a problem, a strange problem in England, is that who owns the virus? In England, we've all decided that the ownership is not the Department of Health. The ownership is the agricultural group, DEFRA. They own it. It's there. It's all to do with birds. And so you could have an awkward situation where things are happening at the interface, and who's in charge? At the moment, DEFRA are definitely in charge, and their job is to protect birds. Their job is to protect farmers. They always have. That's their job. So they're not concerned. I'm not saying they personally don't mind, but that's their primary objective, is to protect the farmer. The primary objective of the Department of Health is to protect humans. So far, there's been no, as far as I can see, DEFRA has not said anywhere that masks should be worn or there's any danger to human beings. They're kind of saying there's almost no danger. Now, you know, I've only spoken to a couple of virologists. I did bring it up at this virology meeting. I didn't get a very good reception, I can tell you. About was a potential threat. They don't want to hear about it. They say, oh, no, we don't want to hear about that. We've had it all that, done all that, done pandemics of flu. So the reception, if you start saying, well, should we be worried? And the answer is yes, you don't get a great reception. Let me tell you that. Try it out yourself and see how far you get and let me know. But I personally, I'm concerned about it and I wouldn't be running around handling them to some extent. And I know at least one virologist is more experienced at it than I am, who's Dutch and works at the interface between the two, you know, the place to be. He's worried about it, and I think Jeffrey might be slightly worried, but you better ask him. So personally, I find it incredible that we're all coasting along. I find it incredible I'm coasting along here, and there's something could be happening a couple of hundred miles away. They had one case. They thought they had one case, and they said that it wasn't a real infection. But that was a bit like DEFRA again. So we're just waiting to see, aren't we?
Yes, we heard about 1919, a few years before. So what about 1920, other years after? The world population became immune?
I don't know the answer, but remember their waves. We've already alluded to it, the waves of infection with this 1918 virus went on all through the 20s, all through the 30s, in a major way, up until 1957, when it had a competitor. In 1957, another pandemic virus, H2N2, arose, possibly up in either Japan or China, probably China, actually. But up until that time, H1N1 was the mistress or master of the race. I mean, every year there was an outbreak caused by a mutating, changing H1N1. And then from 57 onwards, you had the H2 and they co-circulated for a bit. Then the H2 seemed to have vanished, but then it returned back again in 1977. There are many mysteries and arguments among the flu people about all this.
My following up questions, can we use that knowledge, forget about science,
yeah.
Using science, can you make predictions about COVID? Are we finished with COVID?
No,
No,
I've got enough problems with.
We're not. Why not? Why is it different?
I don't think. The predictions would. Got COVID, in my way of thinking, has told us already, is that the mutations are perfectly happy, keeping it going. And look at, we're in year three now, and in England, 1 in 40 people were infected last week. 1 in 40. I can't. Maybe we didn't test for it, but I can't imagine flu, in even before the winter season is getting going, infecting 1 in 40. That's an immense number of people. new infections during that week. So I think COVID's really got us on the run. One positive thing we were talking about, and others thought, maybe COVID is holding out the flu. They may be competitive because of big super viruses in the firmament, like a lion and tiger, like a tiger and a lion in the same wood. You're kind of on both in the same wood. One's going to be dominant. It could be that COVID is dominant. As long as COVID's around, we won't get much flu, including H5. If we get good evidence of COVID dropping off rapidly, then we could have we could look carefully and see, more carefully even, and see whether the flu's going to rise.
Any other quick questions? Yeah, I can, one more.
Returning to the H5 virus.
Yeah.
What's your position?
You're really hammering me on the H5, aren't you? Yeah.
What's your position on the debate on the gain of function experiments?
Yeah.
Which went on.
Yeah.
And then the debate is still rather heated.
Yeah, I think so. Everyone's very nerve-wracked about it. I mean, having accused the Chinese of doing gain-of-function experiments and find out that some of them seem to be funded by the American government, and now there's an anti-Chinese thing running along, it's very tricky territory to be in. I fully supported the work that went on in Holland, and the work that went on in Japan and the United States about the gain-of-function experiments for H5. And they told us that this virus only needed five mutations. H5 was around, as we all know, but it wasn't just doing that big leap. It wasn't going easily from person to person. And the experimental models of the H5 in the ferret, which is always recognized as a good experimental model, told those two groups, that it only needed, say, a total of five mutations, and that virus would then be less lethal in the animal model and more spreadable because it was now be replicating the upper airways and could spread. That's what the gain-of-function experiments told everyone, and that was a dangerous thing to hear about, but a real thing, possibly. So that's as far as I got, and then it was all held up, and there was aggravation about the whole thing, and now I suspect with the aggravation about COVID and where it's come from and all that sort of thing, I suspect it'd be very difficult for anyone to do it and get funded to do it. For the moment.
Thank you so much, Professor Oxford.